loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Facebook announced yesterday that it had taken down 652 fake accounts and pages with ties to Iranian and Russian propaganda organs. The company said there were four different campaigns, with three originating in Iran. Is Facebook jumping on the war hysteria bandwagon? Next, Saudi Arabia is preparing to execute five people, including a woman, for participating in peaceful demonstrations in support of rights for Shia Muslims. The public prosecutor, who reports directly to King Salman, has charged the five with a variety of so-called crimes, including participating in protests, incitement to protest, chanting slogans, attempting to inflame public opinion, filming protests, and providing moral support to rioters. The five could be beheaded as soon as Friday. Then, Russia's foreign minister said that the Taliban have accepted an invitation to attend talks on the future of Afghanistan to be held in Moscow on September 4th. Sergei Lavrov said that the aim of the talks is to encourage the Taliban to abandon hostilities, to engage in a dialogue with the Afghan government, and to protect Russian citizens in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, hopes for a temporary halt in the fighting have broken down following a mass kidnapping and a rocket attack on the presidential palace as President Ashraf Ghani was giving a speech. And then National Security Advisor John Bolton said yesterday that the United States would respond, quote, very strongly, unquote, if forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad use chemical weapons in an offensive to retake Idlib province. But doesn't that just open the door for U.S. allied forces to use chemical weapons and then blame the Syrian government? And finally, tensions between the United States and Turkey, along with the country's economic instability, continue to heat up. Bolton told reporters yesterday that Turkey could end its lira battering crisis with Washington instantly by freeing a detained American pastor. Bolton added that promises of cash from the Qatari government will not save Turkey's economy. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Facebook and propaganda. Facebook announced yesterday that it had taken down 652 fake accounts and pages with ties to Iranian and Russian propaganda organs. The company said there were four different campaigns, with three originating in Iran. Is Facebook jumping on the war hysteria bandwagon? We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf. Dave's an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, as well as a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. Dave, good to have you back.
Hey, good to be back.
Dave, Facebook was not terribly willing, I guess I could say, to share the background of these alleged propaganda pages. All they said was that there were four different groups. Three were Iranian, one was Russian, and the Iranian ones were focused on promulgating anti-Saudi and anti-Israeli propaganda and pro-Palestinian propaganda. Okay, big deal. So what are we looking at here?
I don't know. I mean, if they, if the sites were, maybe they're talking about Press TV sites, or, you know, Iranian news organizations, which would be a real kind of censorship. I mean, that's a perspective that their programs are pretty good. I don't know what they're actually talking about, but it does seem like they're piling on to this, you know, neocon campaign to get the U.S. to go to war with Iran.
You know, that's the really the crux of the issue that I wanted to ask you about. Is what we're looking at here a war and peace issue rather than just a corporate slash propaganda issue? Is this part of a targeting of Iran now that the U.S.'s policy toward Iran has changed?
Yeah, I mean, I'm noticing, broadly speaking, a lot of scare stories coming out in the media that are, you know, trying to create a sort of a hysteria to support, you know, more U.S. military spending, more U.S. military actions and things at this time. And it could also have to do with trying to, you know, a lot of times when presidents are in trouble, you know, politically, they want to start a war somewhere. So, you know, this would just be the latest episode of that kind of thing happening. But you know, and the media are hand in glove in this stuff, because, you know, war hysteria, I guess, if nothing else, boosts ratings. So I was looking at a list of things I've seen, and it's not just Iran. It's Iran, it's Russia, it's China. There was a story a few months ago, widely carried in the U.S. media, about a supposed missile gap in hypersonic cruise missiles, which supposedly the Russians had cleverly jumped on and left the U.S. in the dust. So now the U.S. has to do catch up. The articles were saying the Pentagon's worried that the U.S. doesn't have that developed technology, and they could send fleets of these high-speed, low-flying atomic bomb-carrying cruise missiles all the way from Russia and blow us up, you know. Or there was the story that China was, just recently, that China is having its bomber pilots train for bombing U.S. targets, which is, you know, a totally nothing story, because, you know, our SAC bombers are always doing training as though they were attacking Russia or attacking China. It's like what militaries do. They train for scenarios. But this was done with breathless reporting that, you know, the Chinese are gearing up to, it sounds like they're gearing up to send bombers over and blow us up. And then there was story that, you know, there's this ongoing story that China's building these naval bases on these little rocks that they've built into islands in the South China Sea, as though that's like, you know, a cause for war. And here we are, you know, sending ships and planes into waters claimed by the Chinese provocatively. I don't know what they want to get shot at or something. You know, China has a arguable claim to those territories. So what the U.S. is doing, I don't know, beyond trying to contain China. But there are war stories. And then there's the latest one about a Russian satellite that has a supposedly strange orbit. This is also sourced to the Pentagon, and that it suggests that it could be a space weapon. This is like totally speculative and totally nuts, but it's being done at a time when, you know, Trump is talking about wanting to start another branch of the military service, the Space Force, and they're seriously starting to talk about funding something like that. So they need to have a reason. So what better than a strangely orbiting Russian satellite? And there's always, there have been articles about Russia's new Satan ICBM, which is a name the Pentagon's given it, not what the Russians call it. And of course, Russia's latest S-500 anti-aircraft missiles, which are purported to be a threat to the F-22s and F-25 stealth aircraft, which are actually aircraft that are their own self-imposed threats by the poorness of their design. I don't know. The latest is these heavy breathing articles about Russian and Iranian hackers and cyber warfare. It all points towards this, you know, not so much that there is going to be a war, but that, you know, that they are creating this, trying to create this hysteria. I don't know if it's working in the U.S. that, you know, we're likely to be attacked by what, Iranians? I don't know.
Well, let me ask Walter Smolarek. He's one of the producers of this show, and he's a Sputnik News analyst. Walter, do you think this is Facebook working with the government to advance a conservative foreign policy, something that's anti-Iranian, anti-Russian? Or is this Facebook running scared because they were burned over the last year and now they're trying to protect themselves?
I think it's more of the first possibility that you laid out. I mean, the so-called independent outside helper, I guess, for Facebook when it comes to weeding out these supposed fake pages that are instances of foreign meddling. It's the Atlantic Council, right? Which is this completely neoconservative think tank. It's, you know, partially funded by NATO, by the NATO military alliance. And so I don't think that there's anything independent or impartial about how they're going about advising Facebook on these issues. And I think there's a bigger issue here, too, which Dave is talking about as well. But, you know, the fact that the mainstream media, especially in periods of intensified global conflict, essentially acts as an arm of the Pentagon is something that's absolutely essential to the mission and the functioning of the military-industrial complex in the first place.
Well, that's something that we ought to fear, mm-hmm. frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if you think back to what happened in the run-up to the Iraq War, I mean, the amount of pro-war coverage versus anti-war coverage, you know, the voices, the guests that were invited onto the show, it was completely lopsided. And so now something new has come about over the course of the last, you know, decade or so that I think the Pentagon feels pretty threatened by, which is that there's a decentralization of the means of communication, of the ways that people spread information and news and share it with each other. And so I think one of the biggest utilities, even if this wasn't the motivation to start with, one of the biggest utilities of the whole Russiagate campaign, which is now, I guess, Irangate or Chinagate or whatever, is that there's now a way for the corporations who own these social media platforms to make their media platforms more like the corporate mainstream media that we know, right, which is a very tightly controlled environment where even though there's vigorous debate allowed, it has to remain within bounds. And there are, you know, very clear limits to what is and is not acceptable opinion. I think that's where this is going, right? And there's a pattern to this. I mean, if we think back about the, you know, the Russian Facebook pages and events and whatever, I mean, so first the headlines will have these like really big, scary numbers. So, 652 fake accounts. Oh my God, the Iranians are really meddling and everything. But then you find out later, this is, you know, I'm talking about the Russian pages now. Well, okay, so most of these Facebook ads actually aired either after the election or before Donald Trump was really a candidate. Some of them were seen by no people. Some of them were seen by only a handful of people. Almost all of them have actually nothing to do with the election, right?
Yeah.
So you know, I'll go out on a limb and say, oh, maybe that's the case for these 652 pages. We don't know for sure. But yeah, I mean, I think this is part of a pretty clear pattern.
Dave Lindorf, you've watched these issues unfold, not just related to the so-called Russiagate, but in the past, there have been similar issues. How do you think this is going to play out? What should we be looking at in terms of either the government's next step or Facebook's next step? And what action will give us an idea of whether or not this is a coordinated policy, some sort of a setup?
Boy, that's a tough question, you know, because unless you get some kind of communications and leaks about it from employees, it would be hard to say it's coordinated. But we do know that media companies in general have a history of falling in line with government policy in these war and peace issues. They turn into proponents of war. You know, they bring in the generals that are the retired generals who are serving on arms corporate boards, arms makers corporate boards, and, you know, are totally conflicted because they want to have war, it makes money for their companies.
Sure.
And nobody points that out on these, you know, CNN or MSNBC or any of them, Fox. They don't say, but general, aren't you profiting from war? You know, they just don't do that. And I think, you know, given that Facebook is sort of under the gun from, you know, over issues that it kind of let slip through a lot of, you know, campaign-related stuff from sites that were generated in East Bloc countries, whether officially or not, has them nervous. And so they probably feel a certain amount of pressure to act in the government's, what they see as the government's interest, just to, you know, improve their relationship with the powers that be.
Indeed. We will leave it there. That was the voice of Dave Lindorf. He joined us from Philadelphia. Dave's an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening. He's also a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Saudi Arabia is preparing to execute five people, including a woman, for participating in peaceful demonstrations in support of rights for Shia Muslims. The public prosecutor, who reports directly to King Salman, has charged the five with a variety of so-called crimes, including participating in protests, incitement to protest, chanting slogans, attempting to inflame public opinion, filming protests, and providing moral support to rioters. The five could be beheaded as soon as Friday. We're joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Ali, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ali, it sounds like the Saudis need another $110 billion in U.S. military weapons. What do you think?
They will keep doing this. This is the story of the Saudi monarchy from its inception. They have gotten U.S. Military aid started in the 30s and then in the 50s and 60s. So there is a relationship, a symbiotic relationship, it seems, between the Western powers, the U.K. and the U.S., and the absolute Saudi monarchy. And that's the reality of the facts. No one can dispute it.
You know, I'm wondering, too, why these executions are supposed to happen now. These five people were arrested in 2015. They've been sitting in prison ever since. Is it because the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States is apparently close enough that the Saudis believe that they can get away with it without any reaction from the United States? That the relationship is so important that Donald Trump will just look past this kind of human rights violation? Why is this happening now?
I wouldn't just, blame it on Donald Trump. Obama was no different.
Sure.
And Jimmy Carter was no different. So this is an issue of a system rather than a personality. You know, the Western powers have one interest only in the region, and it's basically to usurp the wealth and independence of those countries, and they care nothing for the people, even for the governments. In fact, for historical purposes, without the Western support, the U.S. and namely the U.K. and the U.S. support to the Saudi monarchy and other regimes in the Middle East, human rights and democracy would have flourished in the Middle East. So it is that Western support for dictators in the Middle East and in the wider world, in fact, we would see much more progressive societies in this part of the world. It's not a surprise that the U.K., for example, looked and supported as a colonial power the worst type of Muslim understanding. Wahhabism was supported and continued to be supported by the UK and then the US to spread and to change Islam itself from just an average religion to a very hostile, very backward religion, and that's why they support the most extreme version of or interpretations of Islam, i.e. Wahhabism and other forms close to it. So this is unfortunately is about hubris and about how these governments in the West look at our at brown people and how they can usurp their oil and wealth and use their land to expand the powers of the United States and the United Kingdom, but with the completely disregard to humanity or any public statements that they make on human rights and respect for humanity in general. Yemen is a great case and a proof of how the policy of the United Kingdom and the U.S. And their bigoted view of Muslim and Arab people in general.
We're speaking with Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Ali, when I was the human rights officer in Riyadh in the early 1990s, I was on a rotation to the State Department. I attended an execution after Friday prayers I wanted to see it just so that I could describe it appropriately in the embassy's human rights report. And it's quite grisly. A prisoner is led out from the back of the mosque. He's obviously, clearly been drugged. He's forced to his knees. His head is put on a chopping block. And the executioner walks out, never breaks stride, lifts up his sword, and chops the prisoner's head off. Everybody shouts Allahu Akbar, and it's over. Now, they'll push foreigners to the very front to watch this with the best view, the best angle, because they want to show them the Saudi form of justice and to show them how quick justice is, and it's certain and it's sure. But it's a lot more than that. There's no right to appeal. The trials are generally fixed. In many cases, you don't have the right to an attorney. And not everybody is executed quickly like this. Some people are crucified still in Saudi Arabia. Women are stoned to death, not in the old biblical sense, but they're forced to their knees and a dump truck of gravel is dumped on top of them and it crushes them. So where is the international outrage? Where is the international pressure? I don't mean to keep hitting on Donald Trump, but why is this still going on in the 21st century without anything from the West to stop it? We have about a minute and a half left.
I don't think there is a desire in the major Western powers to stop this, because it really, in their mind, it supports the interest of domination of the region. The more backward, the weaker, the most divided, the more divided the our countries in the East are, the better it is for UK and US interests, so they can sell more weapons, keep their industrial or military complex working and improving, and the wealth and the brains of the Eastern people will migrate to the West and build the West where the East is not doing so well. And that's exactly what's happening. The United States and the UK, actually, in 1950s, overthrew a secular government in Iran, and they continue to do that. They don't want to see that region basically settled and democratized and prosper by itself. It's not in the best interest in the view of those bigoted leaders in the West.
John, I think what Ali is saying is so important, because it's not just a matter of hypocrisy right now, where the U.S. says, "Oh, look at North Korea, look at Venezuela, look at Iran. We're gonna complain about and argue for human rights or civil rights or democratic rights." It's really, we have to understand the Saudi monarchy as an extension of American and UK
indeed
power. In other words, it is the hand of colonial domination by these Western powers, not hypocrisy. This is what the United States actually truly wants, because it keeps the people down. And it's all about control.
It is. It's all about control. And over the last half century plus, this hasn't changed in any way. We're out of time there. We were joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. Ali is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Russia's foreign minister said that the Taliban have accepted an invitation to attend talks on the future of Afghanistan to be held in Moscow on September 4th. Sergei Lavrov said that the aim of the talks is to encourage the Taliban to abandon hostilities, to engage in a dialogue with the Afghan government, and to protect Russian citizens in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, hopes for a temporary halt in the fighting have broken down following a mass kidnapping and a rocket attack on the presidential palace as President Ashraf Ghani was giving a speech. We're joined from Chicago by Brian Terrell, a longtime peace activist and co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian, there have been many, many attempts at peace talks or just dialogue between a variety of interested partners in this conflict. Do you think anything will come of talks in Moscow that don't necessarily, at least not yet, include the Afghan government?
And the United States.
Yeah, and the United States. You know what? Yeah.
I think the United States media will treat this as another act of aggression by Russia.
If they even bother to carry the news, you know, this is something that I'm a little worried about, too, is that because this is not an American idea, because the United States is not invited, the U.S. media, the corporate media, is going to just pretend that it's not happening.
Yes, that is a danger, too. I think it's interesting that the reason why the Taliban is explaining this rocket attack that just happened and these kidnappings, and they're not joining into the ceasefire that President Ghani has called for, they say that the United States had used last Eid's ceasefire to strengthen their positions. And that sounds cynical, maybe, but you know, remember, this is the country, 1776, George Washington crossed the Delaware and broke the Christmas truce and attacked the Hessian troops gathered in New Jersey. And as children, we were taught to be proud of that. You know, we're really not to be trusted on this. The parties there that don't trust us are being wise and prudent. And it comes down to what not only the Taliban, but also the People's Peace Movement and Malalai Joya and almost anybody interested in the future of the area, is the occupation has to end. The foreign troops have to go. And there isn't much more to talk about with the United States except for reparations than we have to leave. And the presence of troops are not quelling any kind of insurgency, much less defeating it. It's actually encouraging it. And many people believe it's the U.S. occupation and air attacks and support for the Afghan government and military that is the reason why there still isn't an insurgency at all.
And that's really the bottom line, isn't it? That's the Taliban's bottom line, is that foreign troops have to leave the country, that there can't be peace between the two sides until foreign troops are out of the country.
Right, and that's not to justify the horrible attacks that the Taliban
sure
is committing at all. It's just that this is inevitable, and if more than inevitable, it seems almost deliberate to not allow the Afghan people to come to peaceful terms with each other. And we're the U.S. NATO occupation is the biggest obstacle to peace in the region.
Brian Terrell, I want you, because you go to Afghanistan a lot, to politically characterize for, you know, an American audience what the Taliban is at this point. I mean, they started as a one wing of, I would say, an extreme form of Islamic Sharia law in Afghanistan, in schools that were funded by Pakistan. They took power in the political vacuum that existed in Afghanistan following the withdrawal of Soviet troops that supported what was then earlier a socialist government in Afghanistan. Again, they've been out of power now since 2001, 17 years. That's a long time. How would you characterize it politically as a phenomenon?
I'm not an expert in this at all, but I don't think it's anything. It's, at least by the Afghans I talk to, they don't see it as a cohesive political bloc. Very much in disarray, and there's the commanders in the field are suspicious of the spokespeople for Doha from claiming to speak for the Taliban. It's and really, to go back in history, we also have to realize that the Taliban was in those days not just funded and supported by Pakistan, but by the United States as well. But one thing about the Taliban that I've never heard of them having even a shadow of any kind of international program. They're not, unlike Al-Qaeda and ISIS, they have no interest and have shown no interest in extending their ideology beyond the borders of their country. It's a very local and peasant kind of movement, and it's nothing that people in other places have to fear. Any victims of the Taliban, any Western victims of the Taliban, are people who've gone to Afghanistan. They have never gone out of their borders, and they're not responsible for any acts of terrorism outside of their borders.
Brian, let's look at what the other sort of regional players might think about peace breaking out in Afghanistan or the prospects of it. When you look to the west, on the western border is Iran. On the north western border is Turkmenistan. Right up north, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan. Those were former Soviet republics. To the northeast is China. Directly to the east is Pakistan, of course. And then to the east of Pakistan is India. Where does Pakistan sit with the prospects of peace? And of course, there's a new government in Pakistan.
Yeah, I think that's really something to watch. I really can't speak to the what this new government is going to do. It's, you know, Imran Khan is intriguing, and I really don't know, but I do know that I've been watching the progress of the TAPI pipeline. I think here in the United States and around the world, these pipelines are, I think we're seeing how strategically important they are to the environment and to the political nature. And I mean, maybe part of this is that they're actually trying to get this pipeline from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan into Pakistan and India to supply Caspian Sea natural gas, Pakistan and India in particular. That may be one of the driving reasons why it may be time to stop the full-scale combat that's been going on. But of course, there's going to be security concerns about that may lead to more occupation as well. So, you know, with what's happening in Pakistan and Afghanistan, it's a very pivotal time, and it could go lots of different ways.
Let me ask you what you think the actual attitude is of the Trump administration and of the Pentagon. We've talked about this in the past. You know, all wars have an end at some point, I think. Maybe Afghanistan will be the first. Maybe it's the second after Korea, because, of course, there's no peace treaty still ending the Korean War. But the wars end either because one side wins or the other side wins or because both sides become exhausted. Now, there's obvious exhaustion in Afghanistan, and this war is dragged on and on. But the United States isn't exhausted because the U.S. political leaders aren't really paying a political price. There's no rising tide of anti-war opposition in the United States about Afghanistan. It's not really on people's radar. So again, given the fact that the U.S. position is so fundamental to the ultimate outcome in Afghanistan, where do you think the Trump administration, or maybe more importantly, the Pentagon, wants to go in right now?
I think the Pentagon and the Trump administration will be willing to, they are not exhausted, they're not tired. Many of their soldiers are, but the economy the way it is, they will get some more. I think if it's up to the U.S. government, this war will continue, just as I believe if it were up to the Taliban and the Afghan government, the war will continue. And Afghanistan, they're responding to a growing people's peace movement. If the war is going to end on the part of the United States, it's going to have to be because there has to be a resurgence of a peace movement here, that it has to be, ending this war has to be a demand. This war that Vice President Dick Cheney predicted would never end, but be a permanent part of the way that we live. We have to reject that and resist the idea of permanent war. Otherwise, I think it will be. Vice President Cheney will be proven right unless we really change our priorities and demand this war end.
That was the voice of Brian Terrell. He joined us from Chicago. Brian is a longtime peace activist and the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
National Security Advisor John Bolton said today that the United States would respond, quote, very strongly, unquote, if forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad use chemical weapons in an offensive to retake Idlib province. But doesn't that just open the door for U.S. allied forces to use chemical weapons and then blame the Syrian government? We're joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. He's an investigative journalist and member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Rick, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Rick, that's a serious question in the introduction. We know that we don't know things, right? We know that nobody is certain about the chemical weapons that have been released in Syria in the past. The U.S. and U.K. governments have said that it was the Assad government. There's actually no documentary evidence that that is the case. There is certainly evidence that that these chemical weapons releases were done by U.S. allied Syrian organizations. So what is there to stop these U.S. allies from releasing more chemical weapons, chlorine and such.
Staging an attack that makes it look like the Syrian government did it.
And I hate to use the term false flag because it has a certain, you know, connotation to it. But that's really what it would come down to. What's to stop that from happening?
Yeah, and I mean, the Syrian government has won the war. Why would they do the one thing that John Bolton says will draw in American military strike?
Exactly
right. And that's been it from the get-go. Of course, when President Obama initially made a statement and set his so-called red line, that was the invitation, or that was seen as the opportunity for the opposition groups, the armed terrorists, to create some kind of an incident. And of course, the big one that occurred in August of 2013, initially the U.S., of course, blamed the Syrian government, blamed Bashar al-Assad. And in fact, mainstream media in the U.S. still says that they were responsible. But all of the serious investigations of that incident subsequently pointed to the armed factions as being responsible for it, with the very same intention that they've used ever since. And of course, this latest statement from Bolton is just another, it's a violation of international law. It's a threat that the U.S. will use force. And it's another unauthorized assertion that the U.S. is the judge, jury, and executioner of violations of chemical weapons treaty. The U.S. has no authority to do that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
So it's spurious. It's also illegal. I mean, no other country can say, I think you carried out chemical weapons attack, and thus I'm going to attack your country, mm-hmm. a member state of the United Nations, say, with 59 cruise missiles, which is exactly what Donald Trump ordered and proudly proclaimed while he was eating chocolate cake with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping.
Right. Yes. Yes, exactly.
We can look at the integrity of mainstream media in the West if we look at the coverage of this latest incident, because the U.S. Obama, of course, at the end of the day, he decided not to attack Syria, but in April of 2017 under President Trump, and again in April of 2018, the U.S. launched attacks on Syria, on a sovereign state, with the justification that Syria had violated the chemical weapons treaty.
Mm-hmm.
The subsequent investigation, even of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, and the interim fact-finding mission finds that there's no evidence of sarin use, despite the fact that the U.S. and the U.K. claimed that they knew sarin had been involved. So what we've got is the U.S. has no justification now, even from the OPCW, even from the official agency. There's no justification for the attacks that they carried out in April of this year.
And where Rick Sterling, you know, I alluded to the fact that Syria had won the war. They have won the war, right? And yet, what does it mean to have won the war if a big part of your country, like the northeast part of the country, is occupied by Turkish troops,
mm-hmm.
I mean the northwest part, and the northeast part occupied by the United States, it looks as though Syria might be permanently fragmented, or will something else happen?
Right. I think it's premature to say Syria's won the war. The war continues, in fact. The Syrian government has steadily taken control, it's expelled the terrorists, it's done reconciliation with many of the militants who were Syrian, who were fighting with one of the foreign-backed groups, because they've all been foreign-backed, whether it's from Qatar or Saudi Arabia or Turkey or the U.S., they're all of these factions have been foreign-backed. But the Syrian government has been steadily advancing. They recaptured all of the biggest city in Syria, Aleppo. They captured all of East Ghouta, which is a major district on the outskirts of Damascus. Now they're advancing in the south, and they're recapturing all the area there. But the U.S. can prolong the war. The enemies of Syria can just make it continue to bleed, and that's what they're doing. They're prolonging the conflict. It's really there's no other word for it but sinister and evil in a sense, because It's true that Syria it's now more and more clear that the big majority of Syrian people want the war to end, and they support the government. So what the U.S. and U.S. allies are doing there are they're just unnecessarily prolonging the conflict. One other point, Brian and John, that's important for some readers is there's a new report out that's from the Working Group on Syria Propaganda and Media that's a very good investigation of the Douma chemical attack, the alleged chemical attack that took place in April of this year. And it really gives the lie to the claim that that the Syrian government engaged in a chemical weapons attack that was the justification for the U.S. attacking Syria. So now we've got Bolton threatening to use force against Syria, and if something happens, yes, it's going to be a staged incident, just as the event in April. The evidence that's come out in this report strongly suggests that it was a staged incident by the opposition to drag the U.S. into the conflict and to basically get NATO and NATO allies and so forth to attack Syria.
And is that the goal here? I mean, just to sort of repeat this year after year after year to keep the U.S. engaged militarily, to make sure that Assad is unstable, or at least his government is unstable, and to make sure that the fighting continues?
I don't know. I'm sure there's different factions and different arguments in the State Department and the Department of Defense and in the White House. Some are still probably pushing for direct U.S. intervention. They see this as a victory for Syria, Iran, and Russia, and they'll do anything to stop it. Others are a little more sensible, a little less bloodthirsty, and they're saying, well, we have to move on to the next areas of contention. But, the situation is still very dangerous.
Rick Sterling is our guest. Coming up in January 2019 will be the 8th anniversary of when protests began in Syria. They were relatively modest compared to what was going on in Tahrir Square and in Cairo, part of the Arab Spring. The protest came after a prolonged drought that led to a lot of economic and social dislocation. There were other problems that the people were facing that the protests were about. Initially, quite modest protests. And then suddenly, Rick, suddenly these took off and became like an armed struggle. And when you think back to it, it happened right at the same time, March 19th, 2011, when after the UN authorized Resolution 1973, authorizing the use of force against the Gaddafi government in Libya, which led to the sustained bombing of Libya and finally the destruction of that government and the lynching of Gaddafi, the head of state, the 70-year-old head of state, in the streets. It all happened at the same time. I mean, obviously, people in Syria, like people in Libya, had legitimate grievances. You can't have any class society that doesn't have people who have legitimate disagreements with the government and protests. Why did it become what it became? According to the Western narrative, it was because Assad just shot the protesters down. Again, because we don't get a real story from the corporate-owned media, and you've investigated this, why did it go like it did?
It was outside interference. There were people set the stage for it. There was a huge amount of weaponry that was taken into Daraa in the south, across the border with Jordan, and while the conflict in Libya was still going on, terrorists who had been involved in the conflict in Libya were shifting over to travel to Syria, and of course it was even in the fall of 2011. As soon as Gaddafi was killed, and the U.S. Took control of the weaponry of the Libyan state, they started funneling weapons to fueled the Syrian conflict. And that's confirmed in the Department of Defense Intelligence Agency analysis of the summer of 2012.
The American people need to see those documents.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. He's an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Tensions between the United States and Turkey, along with the country's economic instability, continue to heat up. National Security Advisor John Bolton told reporters yesterday that Turkey could end its lira-battering crisis with Washington, quote, instantly, unquote, by freeing a detained American pastor. Bolton added that promises of cash from the Qatari government will not save Turkey's economy. We're joined from Washington by Ambassador Robert Pearson. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey and former director general of the U.S. Foreign Service. The ambassador is now a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute, focusing on U.S.-Turkish relations. Mr. Ambassador, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Ambassador, can you explain to us why this has gotten so bad so quickly? It seems like it's a rather easy problem to solve, is it not?
It actually isn't that hard to solve. The issue is that it's now about the relationship. For years, Turkey has used very abusive language against the U.S. as if they were taking the U.S. for granted. I think the Obama administration sort of absorbed this, but it kept up in the Trump administration. And it's as if Turkey thought that it was more important than the United States in the relationship, and we would just take it. So that plus the obvious fact that President Trump thought he had a deal with President Erdogan and then saw the Turks add more from their side in order to comply finally with releasing Pastor Brunson, I think that's what brought it to a head. Those first sanctions against two ministers were really practically meaningless in the substantive sense because neither one of them had any assets that were going to be seen. It was just a shot across the bow. It's gotten worse since then.
I'm also struck by the language that Erdogan has been using. It seems to me to be very inflammatory. And if something like this is going to be solved diplomatically behind closed doors, you don't want to rile up your own people. But we see it every day in the Turkish press. It's as though the average Turk on the street is getting angrier and angrier, and Erdogan is putting himself in a corner that he can't get out of.
Well, John, and before the ambassador answers, I'm talking to a number of friends who are Turkish, or they either live in Turkey or they're Turk Americans. They say that the mood in Turkey is definitely anti-U.S. at the moment. That it didn't just start with this latest episode, but there was a rising tide of both nationalist sentiment and anti-American sentiment. Ambassador, do you see it that way?
I do see it that way, and it's been going on for years. You know, the Turks government accused us of collaborating with, quote, terrorists, unquote, the Kurds. And we actually won the war against ISIS by working with the Kurds. At the same time, the Turks had groups that were affiliated with Al-Qaeda terrorists in the group of Syrian defense fighters they were supporting. And we never heard a word about that. So things like that really kept digging a little bit deeper into the American psyche. And I think that to some extent, this little dust-up was a little bit like a last straw. It can be solved, but it's what provoked the outburst from Washington, I think.
We're speaking from Washington with Ambassador Robert Pearson. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey and an expert on U.S.-Turkish relations. Ambassador, how do we solve this problem? Again, it doesn't seem so diplomatically difficult. Is Erdogan reasonable enough that while he's even saying perhaps the wrong things to his own media, that he's willing to conduct talks behind closed doors and make this problem go away?
Well, I think that there is a chance that he is. I mean, he did send a delegation to Washington immediately. They had talks here. The Turkish ambassador went over to the White House at Turkish request to talk to them. So if I were constructing a deal, there would be the political side and the economic side. And the political side would involve saying that the charges against Pastor Brunson would not be dropped. The Turks have him indicted. They can try him in absentia, but they could release him to go home to his family in America for medical care. That'll take care of that problem. Then there is a Turkish banker in New York who was convicted of smuggling gold for oil during the Iran sanctions era. He was probably forced into it by his own government. It's a government-owned bank. And letting him go back home to serve out the rest of his sentence would be a nice gesture. I think that could solve that problem. The economic problem is very, very much more difficult. The Turks, in all their conferences with advisors around the world in recent days, have never said three important words: raise interest rates. This is classic economic theory for solving this kind of problem, and they won't do it. So that problem will continue even if the Brunson problem is solved, and Turkey will have to take major steps to reform its economy sooner or later, and sooner is obviously a lot better.
Let's talk also about the Gulen problem, because I think this must have a role in the greater scheme of things. Fethullah Gulen is a Turkish imam. He's a writer. He's a political figure. And it seems like he's accused by the Turkish government of everything under the sun. He used to be an Erdogan supporter. Now he's an Erdogan detractor. And certainly Erdogan has accused him of espionage and treason and such. Now, the president said just a few days ago that he would be willing to at least listen to an extradition request. Is that a real possibility? Would the United States, do you think, be willing to extradite Fethullah Gulen in exchange for Pastor Brunson?
They would not.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that the Turks have an extradition treaty. The treaty has standards, basically the same standards that would cause an American judge to say that there's enough evidence against a suspect to hold him. And that means probable cause. The Turks, despite reams and reams and reams of documents, haven't produced that. They've also produced witnesses against Gulen who obviously seem to have been tortured. They have bruises on their faces. Mr. Erdogan has said that if Gulen comes back to Turkey and the Turkish people want it, unquote, he might institute the death penalty again. So that is actually a standard in any extradition treaty that the United States looks at. So he's complicated his own process for getting this guy back. But there could be more discussions. There could be more careful looking into the activities of Mr. Gulen. But so far, unfortunately, the Turks have just not met the standard that the treaty requires.
We're speaking with Ambassador Robert Pearson. Mr. Pearson is a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey, former director general of the U.S. Foreign Service. The ambassador is now a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute, focusing on U.S.-Turkish relations. Turkey is the eastern flank of NATO. NATO is a U.S.-led military alliance considered still to be very vital by the political and military establishment in the United States. In the 2016 coup or attempted coup, there was a sentiment, I think, by the Erdogan government that the Obama administration, if it did not give the green light, perhaps gave a yellow light to the coup makers, or that it did not do in the early stages, did not express solidarity with Erdogan. That led to a sharp deterioration of relations between the U.S. and Turkey. After that, of course, and that was a monumental event for Erdogan and his fate and his perception about his own security. Thousands, tens of thousands of Turks have been put in jail or lost their job or stripped of parliamentary immunity. What's the impact on long-term U.S.-Turkish relations? And what about the 2016 coup? Was the Obama administration sort of looking the other way or not that worried about it? In other words, if it had succeeded?
Well, it's a good question. I think the U.S. clearly was a little bit late to the microphone to react. They issued their first statement, was watching the situation, which gave Erdogan and his followers a suspicion that somehow the U.S. was behind the coup. They later apologized to the U.S. in a form by saying that they had agreed the U.S. had nothing to do with it. But it set a bad precedent. Mr. Putin called immediately. The European Union reacted very quickly. So that was our bad, and could have been done better and quicker to solve the problem. But Mr. Erdogan also needs a target. He needs a foreign target to explain things that go wrong in his domestic and in his economic choice of measures. So he's made the U.S. that target. And using that as a target, he's allowed himself to become more closely allied with Russia. And he has really cemented a nationalistic core of supporters. He's not trying anymore to go outside that range to attract voters that might be independent or somewhere beyond his outer fringe of firm support. And that's how he plans to run the country. That kind of explains his present attitude, wrapping himself in the flag and in religion to explain that the U.S. is the cause for Turkey's economic decline, when in fact Turkey itself hasn't run a trade surplus since the mid-1970s.
Ambassador Pearson, let me ask you, we have just 30 seconds left. Because nationalism and nationalist politics have their own life, as we know, and things can go beyond even the original intentions of those promoting this kind of politics, can you envision an actual absolute rupture between the U.S. and Turkey such that Turkey could conceivably be at some point out of NATO? We have 30 seconds left, so that's a big question with not much time.
No, but there is no kick-out clause in the NATO treaty. The U.S. is not interested in having Turkey leave NATO. Turkey has important commands within NATO. They are at the meetings every single week expressing their views. It's enormously prestigious for Turkey. They will not voluntarily leave NATO, in my opinion.
That was the voice of Ambassador Robert Pearson. He joined us from Washington. Ambassador Pearson is a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey and former director general of the U.S. Foreign Service. He's now a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute, focusing on U.S.-Turkish relations. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio and now at Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Thank you.